country where environmental justice is a burning issue for black and brown communities?
Well, years ago, my father, William Barber Sr., and people like Ben Chavis and Leon White and Dolly Burrell and others were a part of that movement to stop a company that at night was coming through and dropping PCB in the ditches in front of people's homes late at night, and people were coming up with cancer. They ended up having to lay down in front of those trucks to stop it, and they called it environmental racism because they were doing it in a predominantly black community. But it's also environmental classism as well, because that's a poor community. And what Secretary Regan announced yesterday was finally, and this is a great first step, is that the government is saying we're going to put 200 employees and billions of dollars in an agency that has power to protect, power to sue, power to stop, power to investigate what's going on, that has the power to say to corporations, you cannot do this anymore, to communities, treat corporations like people and people like things. This is an important first step. And Secretary Regan came to Jackson yesterday and also announced that he has the green light to say to Mississippi government, if you don't do right here, we can pull that federal money. You know, that's what the federal government can do. They can pull all of the federal money that comes into a state when a state is engaging in outright racism, outright classism, and outright harm toward poor people, low-wage people, disabled people. This is what we have to have. We have to have equal protection under the law. Everything we're talking about was created by bad policy. Therefore, it can be fixed by good policy. And so here we are in Jackson, but we could go to Oak Flats in Arizona, what's happening to the Apache people there in their water. We could still do it with Flint. We could go to what's happening up with these pipelines that are being built across the country. I just got a call from a community up in Michigan, predominantly white community, that Minnesota, excuse me, that's having similar problems. The Corps of Engineers could join with the state and the federal government to fix these problems, and should fix these problems, because otherwise what we're doing is poisoning people. And to think of the fact that a place like Jackson and other places had this going on during COVID, when the one thing the doctor said you needed during COVID was clean water. So we don't know yet how many people died in Jackson or got sick beyond where they should have because of poison water, because it has not been fixed, because there's been a 50-year Band-Aid approach, because they've lied on the mayors of Jackson and said they didn't have a plan, because they have refused to fix it. This is what has to be explored. One of the things we're talking about—
We have 10 seconds, Bishop.
We're talking about getting some public policy experts and doctors to help do that analysis so that people know really what's going on and we can fight to change it.
Bishop William Barber of the Poor People's Campaign and Repairers of the Breach, speaking to us from Jackson, Mississippi, headed to Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And we will continue to cover both of these issues. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Tune in to KBOO on Wednesday, October 5th for Dead Moon Night,
a four-hour extravaganza
celebrating the 2017 event when 1,100 rockers showed up outside Portland City Hall
to commemorate the legendary band Dead Moon in an official city proclamation of October 5th as Dead Moon Night.
Again, that's Dead Moon Night, Wednesday, October 5th, from 8 p.m. till midnight.
Here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, another Portland area Burgerville plans to unionize, Oregon's housing market cools off, and in international news, a report on China's human rights violations was suppressed for over a year. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, September 27th, 2022. I'm Eric Leuschner. A sixth Portland area Burgerville staff will vote to join a union in the coming months. Workers at the Southeast Powell and 25th location announced their intention to join the Burgerville Workers Union, the first fast food union in the nation. These employees say they were prompted to unionize when a manager at their store sexually harassed an underage employee and wasn't fired. They were allegedly transferred to a different Burgerville location. The workers wrote a press release stating that if that manager isn't fired by the end of the week, they intend to escalate their actions. That could look like a picket, a strike, or a call to boycott the store. Workers at the Southeast Powell store will vote on whether to unionize in the coming months. The Burgerville Workers Union started organizing in 2018 and reached their first contract with management in 2021. Oregon's housing market is seeing a bit of cooling thanks to increased interest rates. KBOO's Josh Salem has more on what it means for homebuyers and sellers.
Interest rates are rising and prices are leveling off, contributing to a cooling Oregon housing market. But it's not yet a disaster for sellers. Drew Coleman, past president of the Oregon Realtors Association, says, quote, "I like to describe the market as having gone from white hot to red hot," end quote. Mortgage payments rise as the U.S. Federal Reserve raises its benchmark interest rates. The Fed raised rates by another 0.75 percentage points last week. The driver behind the rate increases was to cool prices and inflation. This has been reflected in the Oregon housing market. Deschutes County, which usually has high prices due to housing demands in Bend, saw the most drastic dip in median listing price, going from $777,000 in May to $707,000 in August. Over the same period, Multnomah County saw a slight dip from $545,000 to $525,000. Homes are sitting in the market longer than they were earlier this year. In Deschutes County, the median number of days that homes sat on the market in May was 29. It rose to 50 by August. In Multnomah, the median number of days went from 28 to 38. Oregon's inventory of active home listings started dropping right around the start of the pandemic, hitting its lowest point in January of 2021. Inventory still is nowhere near where it was in August of 2019, when there were 18,300 homes for sale in Oregon versus only 12,000 this August. Rising appreciation rates, which tend to measure how much homes have increased in value, are cooling off as well. Economists predict that 2022 will end with about 9.3% appreciation nationwide, and then drop to a more typical 4.19% in 2023. They may fall further, approaching the 3% level in 2024. Realtors like a 3 to 5% appreciation rate, which they say helps homeowners gain equity, but also allows people to enter the market much better than with very high rates. Experts say Oregon's most recent homebuyers should not worry about permanently losing equity, even if they bought at market peak or above asking price. Over time, rising house prices usually make up for those types of potential losses. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
The governing body for Oregon high school sports and its top soccer rules interpreter have apologized after the interpreter published sexist instructions for how referees should treat boys and girls soccer. Patrick Duffy remains the soccer rules interpreter for the Oregon School Activities Association. He wrote a memo earlier this year, coaching referees, stating that physical contact between girls' soccer players needed to be carded more liberally than boys' soccer. He wrote that boys are better at playing through contact than girls are, and that referees need to be more strict at girls' soccer games. He wrote, quote, "Do not referee a girls' game the same way you would a boys' game." The memo was met with backlash from soccer coaches across the state. They say both groups play the game with the same rules and they should be enforced the same. One told Oregon Live that girls' games can be held up by their overzealous referees, who throw out cards at shoulder contact, which shouldn't happen in a boys' game. Duffy has apologized and has been assigned implicit bias training. Even so, he remains in his role as the soccer rules interpreter. Voters in King County, Washington, will have a property tax increase to consider on their ballot next April. It's projected to raise over $1 billion in the next decade to fund behavioral health treatment in Washington's most populous county. If passed, The tax would go into effect in 2024, costing the average homeowner $121. The funds would be used to construct 5 regional crisis care centers around the county and help other services in the Seattle region's ailing mental health system. One of these crisis care centers would be youth-focused. County commissioners who referred the property tax to the ballot said that there's no walk-in service available in the whole county. Where there are services available, people have to be referred, either by police or a hospital or a mobile crisis team. King County has steadily lost long-term care beds for mental health since 2018. Now only 244 remain for a population of over 2 million. The county also plans to use funds to increase long-term beds and bolster the workforce, which has been exiting the profession from pandemic burnout and low wages. Hunger is a timely topic, with the country making its way out of the pandemic and now fighting inflation. That's the backdrop for the White House's Conference on Hunger, Nutrition, and Health on Wednesday. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story.
It's been more than 50 years since the White House held a gathering about the effects of hunger across the nation. In 1969, the White House held its first and only conference on hunger, nutrition, and health. On Wednesday, the Biden administration is reviving the meeting, bringing together members of Congress and groups working to fight food insecurity. Eric Williams with Second Harvest Inland Northwest says it's very timely, considering the recent pressures on families.
We all were spinning and pedaling really, really hard during the pandemic, and we kind of got through that and thought, well, thank goodness that's better and things like hunger will be reduced. And then first of the year, inflation hit.
Williams says between 2021 and 2022, need has gone up 35% in the network his organization serves. The conference will be streamed live online and include remarks in the afternoon from President Joe Biden. The Biden administration has laid out a lofty goal ahead of the meeting. It says it wants to end hunger and increase healthy eating and physical activity by 2030, which the administration adds will lead to a reduction in chronic diseases like diabetes and hypertension. Williams says there are a number of strategies to tackle hunger, including reducing the amount of food that goes uneaten.
We, the whole industry, that includes grocery stores, et cetera, are getting a little bit more efficient, and we need to get even more efficient so that the food that's produced does not get wasted. Entirely too much food is wasted.
Williams cites other pressures on the food supply, such as drought in California, which provides much of the nation's fresh produce, and increased freight costs. However, Williams notes Washington is the biggest apple producer in the country, and the Inland Northwest also is good at growing crops like lentils, potatoes, and onions. He says because of this, about two-thirds of the food that his organization distributes is donated. For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Senator Kristen Sinema defends the Senate filibuster, and the Congressional Budget Office estimates student loan forgiveness could cost $400 billion. With those stories and more, it's Mary Sherman with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Our last president wanted to eliminate it every couple of days. Our current president talks about it on Twitter all the time.
Arizona Senator Kyrsten Sinema says they're both wrong. The moderate argues the legislative tactic avoids all-or-nothing political battles, which result in no action.
The importance of the 60-vote threshold is to ensure that no one gets everything they want, that you compromise, that you find that middle ground. And by doing so, you're much more likely to pass legislation that stands the test of time, that will not be reversed when the next party gains power.
Sinema spoke at Republican Senator Mitch McConnell's Academic Center.
She is today what we have too few of in the Democratic Party, a genuine moderate and a deal maker.
Democrats criticize Sinema for aligning with Republicans. Sinema, along with Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia, have blocked several key Democratic policy bills, proving to be the most influential members of the 50-50 divided chamber. The Congressional Budget Office is putting a $400 billion price tag on the Biden administration's federal student loan forgiveness plan. It would forgive $10,000 for borrowers earning up to $125,000 and $20,000 for Pell Grant recipients. Conservative groups call it a handout and are considering legal action, but Democratic Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley argues it will change and save lives.
I get emotional thinking about the profound impact this will have for our families, especially families that have been systematically denied the opportunity to own or build generational wealth.
An estimated 43 million borrowers share about $1.6 trillion in student debt. Michigan Congressman Andy Levin's staff became the first to vote to form a union under a new House rule. Workers in the offices of California Democrat Ro Khanna and Minnesota Democrat Ilhan Omar also have votes scheduled this week. Days after threatening to escalate the war in Ukraine, Russian President Vladimir Putin granted former NSA contractor Edward Snowden citizenship in his country, where he's been living in exile. Snowden is accused of espionage for leaking intelligence information to the media. State Department spokesperson Ned Price said the United States position hasn't changed, and Snowden should return to the U.S. to face justice.
Perhaps the only thing that has changed is that as a result of his Russian citizenship, apparently now he may well be conscripted to fight in Russia's war in Ukraine.
Snowden faces up to 30 years in prison in the U.S. Florida is bracing for Hurricane Ian's landfall, which could hit Tampa by mid-Wednesday. Governor Ron DeSantis activated thousands of National Guard members.
We've issued waivers of weight restrictions for commercial trucks to ensure we have ample fuel and resources coming into Florida. Make sure you're prepared. There's no need to panic buy.
Along with winds of 100 miles per hour or more, Florida's west coast could see life-threatening storm surges. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our A-Trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Totality of Circumstances with Sam Bowman and Jasmine Moneymaker. At 6, it's Eco Justice Radio. Then at 7, Rising Up with Sonali. Tonight's weather will be clear with a low of 56 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will have a 50% chance of rain with a high of 69 degrees. Today in history, in 1824, the world's first public railway to use steam locomotives was opened in England. The quote of the day is from American musician, actress, and star of Portlandia, Carrie Brownstein, who was born today in 1974. She said, quote, "I think that art, making music or comedy, is a way of putting yourself on the map and trying to find other people out there with you." Studies show that Latina women and other women of color face lower chances of surviving a heart attack outside a hospital in disadvantaged neighborhoods. The American Heart Association launched Heroes Saving Hearts, a campaign designed to raise awareness about CPR and reduced stigma around performing it. Mark Richardson has more.
Cardiopulmonary resuscitation, or CPR, can save lives after a heart attack, but in some communities, too few people know how or are hesitant to perform the procedure. Research indicates women of color, particularly Hispanics, have a lower chance of surviving a heart attack outside of a hospital. So the American Heart Association has launched an initiative to raise CPR awareness and help overcome any stigma surrounding it. Cardiologist Kelly Epps Anderson, a board member of the AHA's Greater Washington region, says in an emergency, where you live can determine whether you survive.
Hispanic and Latino and Black people are at higher risk for out-of-hospital cardiac arrest, with a poor prognosis in part due to long-standing societal policies that have resulted in limited access to quality health care and to education.
She says public service announcements for the Heroes Saving Hearts program tie in with Hispanic Heritage Month, encouraging people to learn life-saving techniques. She says the study found both cultural and educational barriers to performing hands-only CPR.
Only 39% of women in cardiac arrest actually receive CPR from strangers in public, compared to 45% in men. We don't know exactly why, but we think that the problem may be that there are fears around inappropriate touching or hurting a woman.
Epps Anderson says other barriers to learning or using CPR include fear or distrust of police, financial concerns, immigration status, language barriers, and even the possibility of violence. Some of these are highlighted when the person having the heart attack or stroke is a woman. Epps Anderson says hands-only CPR is as effective as conventional CPR during the first few minutes of a cardiac arrest and can double or triple a person's chance for survival.
We know that Hispanic and Latino communities who are familiar with the methods are significantly more confident that they can perform either type of CPR than the general population.
For more information or to find a CPR course, look online at heart.org. I'm Mark Richardson.
The Oglala Sioux tribe is helping to create a new youth group with native and culturally competent staff. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Oglala Sioux Tribe is supporting the creation of a new nonprofit youth mentorship organization. South Dakota Public Broadcasting CJ Keene has more.
The new youth mentor group acknowledged its official opening recently during a tribal government signing ceremony. Tasha Friday is the national director of tribal programs for Friends of the Children. She says this represents an intentional step into Native communities.
We've always served Indigenous youth, but never in the way that we're doing it here at the Friends of the Children Kesapa, which is grounded in cultural life ways. The staff is Indigenous and culturally competent in understanding of the life ways and really incorporating that in every level.
Tribal leaders work to ensure Friends of the Children would be a good addition to the community. Oglala Sioux Tribe Vice President Alicia Mousseau highlighted the effort of tribal government to vet the nonprofit.
They really did their due diligence to make sure that this is a good program for our community, and so we're excited to carry this forward.
The HESAPA chapter's executive director is Val Big Eagle. She says she is humbled by the support of the tribe's government.
When nonprofits come in, we just are a little wary, right? And making sure that they're here for the right reasons and that they're doing things the right way and working with the community and not saying, hey, this is what you need to do to heal yourselves, but asking the community, what do you need from us to make sure that this can happen? And what healing-informed practices would you like to see?
The chapter aims to support 16 mentorships open to Native and non-Native kids. They will start working with young kids 4 to 6 years old and continue through high school. For National Native News, I'm CJ Keene.
The economy is usually a big topic during elections. And with midterms near, recent inflation woes are being felt, including in tribal areas. Indigenous leaders in North Dakota hope it spurs turnout. Mike Moen reports.
Douglas Yankton, chairman of the Spirit Lake Nation, says inflation has impacted the programs that provide an array of services on his reservation. Even though some of the pressure has eased, the ripple effect is still there.
A lot of those services don't go as far as they used to. Let's say transportation, for instance. With the prices of gas and oil and everything, we have to figure out new routes to accommodate for that full week.
He adds COVID still is a concern. Cases were disproportionately felt by Native populations. And Yankton says local businesses are hurting, with some residents worried about close contact. State Representative Ruth Buffalo, a Democrat from Fargo, says inflation impacts Native voters in urban settings, too. Buffalo says there's a lack of a commerce hub in Fargo to secure traditional Native food staples and other items.
So like when we go to Minneapolis, we can stop at Native-owned businesses where wild rice might be sold or different types of coffee and, of course, jewelry.
And she suggests the lack of a local hub makes it harder for local Native entrepreneurs to sell their products. On a broader scale, Buffalo says there's another key issue Indigenous voters are watching.
We know that for decades, many people have been working behind the scenes to get rid of tribal sovereignty for their own benefit. And so we really need to get to the ballot boxes to protect tribal sovereignty.
Buffalo is the first female Native American Democrat elected to North Dakota's legislature and is seeking re-election. One of her opponents, Republican Joshua Christie, says he would support tribal sovereignty.
That was Mike Moen reporting. The Yurok tribe is hosting its first ever statewide policy summit on missing and murdered Indigenous people in October. The Northern California Tribal Summit on MMIP is expected to bring together more than 100 tribal leaders, advocates, and lawmakers. Attendees will discuss historical and present-day contributing factors and explore remedies to reduce risks to Indigenous people in the U.S. I'm Antonio.
A UN report on China's violations of human rights was kept under wraps for over a year. But even though it's been realized the report doesn't recommend follow-up actions, now we go to global citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. On August 31st, Michelle Bachelet ended her tenure as UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. She did it during her last moments in office, authorizing release of a damning report on China's treatment of Muslims in the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region. The report had been sitting in her office for over a year, and its release followed on a much criticized trip to Xinjiang Bachelet undertook in May, and which I've reported on previously. Little wonder that Bachelet delayed release for over a year. Though the report does not accuse China of genocide, it takes Beijing to task on numerous other counts of human rights abuse. It charges China with torture, forced medical treatment, and sexual violence. It says that Beijing has engaged in, quote, far-reaching, arbitrary, and discriminatory restrictions on human rights and fundamental freedoms, in violation of international laws and standards. The report, according to Amnesty International Secretary General Agnès Callamard, lays bare the scale and severity of the human rights violations taking place in Xinjiang. The inexcusable delay in releasing this report casts a stain on the UN Human Rights Office's record, but this should not deflect from its significance. That significance can also be gauged by noting China's angry response, which was twofold: a brief statement castigating the Bachelet report, and a lengthy document, Fight Against Terrorism and Extremism in Xinjiang, Truth and Facts. For the most part, the Chinese defense borders on the absurd. It portrays Xinjiang as a human rights paradise, and China's policies toward ethnic minorities as empowering and economically advantageous. The document also contains more traditional Chinese defenses, such as rejecting foreign interference in China's internal affairs and upholding China's fight against terrorists and separatists. Almost needless to say, the debate over China's treatment of the Uyghurs has much less to do with international law and human rights than with politics. Governments beholden to China, including those with substantial Muslim populations, have been silent. Some have even extradited Uyghurs to China. In fact, China actually garnered support in a rather obscure committee of the UN called the Human Rights Council Dialogue of Special Rapporteurs on Unilateral Coercive Measures. That little group oversees countries' unilateral sanctions that may, quote, negatively impact the human rights of direct or indirect targets. At a meeting of the Special Rapporteurs on September 14, China's representative attacked the U.S. and some Western countries for their unilateral coercive measures that, in his view, violated international law and were used as a political instrument to subvert Chinese sovereignty. The reference was to sanctions imposed on China for the mass repression in Xinjiang, making China the victim and the sanctioning countries the human rights violators. On the other hand, Western governments have led the way in sharply criticizing Chinese policies, supporting forums on conditions in Xinjiang, prohibiting imports from Xinjiang, sanctioning surveillance technology exports to China, and accusing China of genocide or cultural genocide or crimes against humanity, as in the Bachelet report. But the report does not recommend follow-up action. Neither does another body, the G7 group of major economies, which might have been expected to recommend punishing China. When the G7 foreign ministers met on September 22nd, they welcomed the report, said they were deeply concerned by serious human rights violations in Xinjiang, underlined the importance of the UN following up, but in the end said that they merely urged China to fully respect human rights. Not much there. By the way, let's not forget about Tibet, another instance of long-standing Chinese systematic repression. A new report shows that the Chinese authorities have carried out mass DNA collection for some time in Tibet, justified, as in Xinjiang, by the lie that doing so will guard against terrorism and fight crime. I suppose we should celebrate the fact that the UN's report on Xinjiang was not suppressed in order to mollify Beijing. But we're also reminded that, in an ideal world, the UN's human rights offices would be investigating and reporting on all countries' systematic repression of human rights and recommending meaningful ways to stop it. One last item. Xi Jinping's repression does have American supporters. For example, Donald Trump, who said at a rally in September, quote, "He rules with an iron fist, 1.5 billion people. Yeah, I'd say he's smart. Wouldn't you say he's smart? He's not smart, Donald. He's brutal. You will never understand the difference, and neither will Xi Jinping." Thanks for listening. I'm Mel Gertow for The Global Citizen.
A house in Utah was designed to be totally fossil fuel free. The owner gives tours to show people what sustainable living can really look like. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. New home construction often requires lots of lumber, foam insulation, drywall, and siding, but not in Rosalind McCann's case.
We built our house with straw bales, earthen plaster, earthen floors.
McCann says that when designing her home in Moab, Utah, sustainability was foremost on her mind. So she chose non-toxic building materials, including rectangular bales of straw, which create thick, well-insulated walls. And to avoid burning fossil fuels, McCann bought rooftop solar panels. She says they generate enough electricity to meet all of her household's energy needs, including heat, cooking, and lights.
We wanted to completely step away from the fossil fuel industry as much as possible. And so no gas lines, so we have no gas bill.
To conserve water as Utah gets hotter and drier, McCann installed what's called a gray water system. Water from the shower and washing machine flows into pipes that drain directly onto the landscape, watering her fruit trees, herbs, and perennials. McCann gives tours to people interested in seeing how the house is built and functions, and she envisions a future in which sustainable building and living is the norm, not an anomaly.
It's just the way we should be building our houses.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, September 27, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem and Mel Gertov. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tegetoff, Mary Sherma, Antonia Gonzalez, Edwin J. Vieira, Mark Richardson, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 8, it's Wednesday Talk Radio with Paul Roland. At 9, Flashpoints. At 10, it's Art Talk Bus Stop. Then at 11, it's Radio Zine. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support for our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm.